This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, the Obama administration takes preemptive policy actions in its final weeks, so far on offshore drilling and a Muslim registry. The Electoral College formalizes Donald Trump's win as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party pushes for change from within. And Los Angeles outlaws sleeping in cars, further criminalizing homelessness. We'll hear from those directly affected. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. In its final weeks in office, the Obama administration is dismantling the regulatory framework for what President-elect Donald Trump called a Muslim registry while on the campaign trail. The Department of Homeland Security issued an update to the Federal Register, removing rules for the post-9/11 National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS program, calling it obsolete and effectively eliminating all remnants of the dormant program as of Friday. Under NSEERS, male visa holders from 24 Muslim-majority nations were required to go through a special registration process. The government suspended the program in 2011, but left its legal framework intact until now. Trump returned to the registry theme this week after an attacker in Germany drove a truck into a Christmas market, killing 12 people. And in another of what's shaping up to be a series of preemptive policy strikes against the incoming administration, President Obama banned offshore drilling in large areas of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans this week. Climate change and environmental activists quickly hailed the decision. The Alaska delegation to the U.S. Congress swiftly condemned it. The action comes as Trump stacks his cabinet with climate change deniers and fossil fuel industry insiders. Obama said the ban is designed to permanently protect fragile ecosystems and block massive infrastructure investment in the carbon economy that exacerbates climate change and slows the transition to renewable energy. Rosemary Atungarok is an Inupiat grandmother, former mayor of Barrows, Alaska, and environmental justice advisor for the Alaska Wilderness League. She says the decline of ice already caused by climate change increases the risks of drilling in the Arctic.
The changes that are occurring in the Arctic, we don't have the infrastructure in place to respond to an adverse event. The infrastructure that has been in place was not designed to be in place without the protective mechanisms of the Arctic environment. Having a large ice sheet is protective, but when you have the fall storms and 30-foot waves and you do not have the protection of the permafrost in the ice.
In a statement, Obama said one of his goals was to create a strong Arctic economy, but the Alaska delegation resoundingly decried the move, arguing that it could cause job loss. But Atungarok says the job market in Alaska is beginning to shift.
Job employment process of our state has been focused on oil and gas for decades, and the diversity that should have occurred generations ago is slowly evolving.
Obama issued the drilling ban in concert with a similar action by his Canadian counterpart, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. First Nations and environmental groups have been increasingly critical of what they see as Trudeau's backtracking on campaign promises to protect the environment and respect Indigenous sovereignty. Recently approved expansions of pipelines in the Canadian provinces of Alberta and British Columbia are meeting fierce opposition from local Indigenous communities. Currently, two such groups are challenging the Canadian federal government before the Supreme Court. They argue the government failed to seek their informed consent for development projects, which they say threaten the values of their culture and the well-being of the environment. Patrick Barrios reports from Ottawa.
In a lawsuit currently before the Supreme Court of Canada, the Chippewa of the Thames and the Clyde River Inuit say the Canadian government did not fulfill its constitutional duty to consult Aboriginal communities before approving fossil fuel projects in their territories. Both sides made their arguments before the High Court in a joint hearing late last month. Nader Hassan, the Clyde River Inuit's legal counsel, says the court's decision will establish a legal precedent defining what it means to properly consult Aboriginal communities.
This case, at its core, is about the soul of Canada and what kind of a nation we want to be. Do we want to be a nation that takes our obligations to First Nations and Indigenous peoples seriously? Or do we want to be a nation that allows governmental bodies and industry proponents to reduce Aboriginal rights to basically a checklist item?
The Clyde River Inuit are opposing a seismic exploration project near Baffin Bay. This project looks for oil deposits to sell to companies interested in offshore drilling. As described in a National Energy Board report, a seismic ship would travel back and forth for 5 years, towing up to 34 air guns. Every 15 seconds, these air guns would produce underwater sound blasts of 230 decibels. That's louder than a space shuttle launch, and more than loud enough to instantly kill a human. Hassan says the Clyde River Inuit are concerned that seismic exploration will harm marine wildlife integral to their culture and diets.
In Clyde River, you can't just go into your local supermarket and buy all of your nutritious food. That food is prohibitively expensive. It's all airlifted from the south, and you'll be paying 5-10 times more than you would in an Ottawa or Toronto supermarket. So people up there depend on traditional food sources for their nutritious food. The ringed seal, the harped seal, the bearded seal, the narwhal, the bowhead whale, all these traditional food sources.
The National Energy Board's report seems to validate the Clyde River residents' concerns. It states that over 180 species of fish have been identified within the project area, as have marine mammals such as the endangered bowhead whale. Despite this, the board approved the project, citing dozens of proposed mitigation measures. Another issue before the court deals with a controversial pipeline project. The Chippewa of the Tams are opposing the reversal and expansion of Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline. The Energy Delivery Company's website states that the pipeline's expansion allows for transportation of heavy oil. The National Energy Board approved this project in 2014, and it is already in operation. The board claims potential damage to Indigenous land is likely minimal, and that it would be appropriately mitigated. But Chippewa ceremonial drummer Todd Riley says environmental damage is inevitable if oil continues to flow.
It's not if it spills, it's when. Everything man-made is going to fail. How are we going to fix that? It's going to take generations. We've got to get all our First Nations together and stop this. This decision here is big.
Canadian Indigenous communities say fossil fuel projects threaten a lifestyle they've held onto for thousands of years and contradict a value system that prioritizes environmental integrity over profit margins. Hundreds rallied outside the Supreme Court in support of the Chippewa of the Tams and the Clyde River Inuit during the joint hearing in November. Cree Chief Mistawasis explains that the natural world is integral to First Nation identities.
The trees, the birds, the animals, the fish, the environment is a library. As Indigenous people, it's our duty to consult with the water. It's our duty to consult with the air. That is our library. We're the librarians.
Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, took a moment to survey the crowd before his address. Among the gathered, shivering in the cold, were elders and youth, Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike. Bellegarde says such unity is essential if Indigenous rights and voices are ever to be respected.
We don't see any color. We don't see black people, yellow people, white people, red people. We are the two-legged tribe. And if this worldview that I just described can be taken up by governments and industry, it'll be a powerful world for all of us.
The Crown claims that, through the National Energy Board, it has fulfilled its constitutional responsibility to consult Aboriginal communities. The justices are reviewing the case and are expected to issue a ruling in the coming month. Patrick Barrios, FSRN, Ottawa.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
The Electoral College met Monday at state houses across the country in what turned out to be the largest departure from the ceremonial routine in U.S. history. So-called faithless electors, Delegates who refused to vote in line with their state's election results popped up in states like Minnesota, Maine, Ohio, and Washington. Protesters disrupted the vote in Wisconsin and were ushered from the room before the state's electors cast their votes for Donald Trump. And after significant procedural delays, electors in Texas put Trump over the top of the required 270 votes necessary to capture the presidency of the United States. As the nation awaits the inauguration, analysts and some Democrats are pondering whether the Democratic Party can regain a competitive edge without significant changes in its leadership and strategies. FSRN's Evan Davis spoke with activists in Central Ohio who are already working to reform the Democratic Party at the local level.
Ohio lost its status as a swing state in the last election as Donald Trump bested Hillary Clinton by 52-43%. The failure of the Clinton campaign to rally the Democratic Party base may reflect a feeling among some Democratic Party voters that their party leadership is simply out of touch with the concerns of its rank-and-file constituents. Former Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner has observed this trend since 2010, when she sought her party's nomination to run for the U.S. Senate. The party chose then-Lieutenant Governor Lee Fisher over Bruner in spite of the fact that early polling suggested that Bruner had a better chance of winning in the general election.
When I look at the Democratic Party nationally, they've become very establishment in terms of being affected and swayed by big moneyed interests that typically supported Republicans. We can't take for granted our base. I see some reticence on people's part to step out, to step outside of what they perceive to be the strictures of sometimes overt and covert leaders of the party. And when they do that, when is the revolution ever going to happen?
Speaking to the rank and file was the strong suit of the Bernie Sanders campaign, which emphasized making government more accountable to the electorate. After the Democratic Party primary, the campaign has continued in the form of a citizens' lobby group called Ohio Revolution. Pooja Datta is one of the spokespeople for the Ohio chapter.
I think the Democrats have this tendency of expecting certain blocks of voters to be their firewalls without really being there for them. I want to get beyond that.
Datta's group is forming chapters throughout the state where they plan to field progressive candidates for local offices.
We are going to be working within the party. The way we're looking at it, infrastructure is already built for the Democratic Party, and it's going to take twice as long if we want to build an infrastructure outside of that, so it makes more sense to utilize what we do have. We are looking to run people for city council, for school boards around town. It's sort of the brand new Congress model. Instead of nationally, we're doing it only in Ohio.
Others are focusing on a different kind of reform from within strategy. Will Petrick is with a group called Yes We Can. It has a progressive platform, and it sets its sights on gaining seats in the Ohio Democratic Party's Central Committee, where Petrick now serves as a ward captain.
We thought, what better place to start than the local level? Partly because, you know, these wards, in some cases, there were less than 600 registered Democrats. Some wards had up to 2,000, but it was at a scale where grassroots organizing works.
At a recent party forum in Columbus, all of the candidates spoke of the party's need to do a better job of listening to constituencies that have been overlooked for several election cycles, as well as to adopt a more progressive stance on issues of concern to the economically disadvantaged. But transforming those talking points into action will be necessary to recapture the support of people like Dorian Wingard, an urban African-American professional who voted in November but who chose no candidate in the presidential race.
And my ancestors did not fight, die, and bleed for me to have the right to waste a vote. They did that so I could have the ability and the right to vote. Voting for either one of those candidates would have been a wasted vote, in my opinion.
Like Datta and Petrick's groups, Wingard plans to remain involved in local politics, but as for supporting Democratic Party candidates, he remains skeptical.
I asked the same question about, we're in Columbus, Ohio, so we've had an African-American mayor for almost 18 years prior to the new incoming mayor. And there are parts of the city and this community that looked the exact same when he took office as they did when he left office, while other areas have bloomed and flourished and grown exponentially. I say that to make to point to the Democratic Party's approach. There's been nothing. the approaches and the policies, be they Democratic or Republican, yield the same end result, which is deficits, which are deficits in our communities, families that are hungry and not able to do what they need to do, unemployment, chronic unemployment and underemployment, homelessness, poor quality education. The list goes on and on and on. So candidates have to do a little bit more than what they've been doing.
Although some Ohio voters may have been deterred by recent limitations on voting rights, including voter ID requirements, shortened early voting hours, and purges of voter registrations, the undisputedly largest block of voters in this last election were neither Democrats nor Republicans, but simply the ones who chose to stay home. Evan Davis, FSRN, Columbus, Ohio.
In Zimbabwe, the country's long-ruling party has cleared the way for nonagenarian Robert Mugabe, one of the world's longest-serving leaders, to run for another presidential term. The 92-year-old is a polarizing figure inside the Southern African country, where he's revered by many as a hero of the country's post-colonial liberation. But others blame him for chronic economic mismanagement that has resulted in one of the world's highest rates of unemployment. FSRN's Gerikai Chaunza explains.
A visibly shaky President Robert Mugabe addressed Parliament on December 6, in which he appealed for calm amongst rising discontent and street violence over the country's struggling economy.
Let us continue to find national pride in our core values of unity, hard work, and freedom. But let us also thank our forces for the peaceful environment that we have.
Those forces he mentions are the riot police, who in recent months have routinely broken up peaceful rallies by opposition parties and young Zimbabweans angry over increasing desperate economic conditions. One of those young men is 31-year-old Donald Mavuzi, who graduated university with an urban planning degree.
We actually respect Robert Mugabe. We even respect the role that he played during the liberation struggle. He fought very hard to make sure that Zimbabwe gains political independence.
But President Mugabe's role in 1980 independence movement, during which some 20,000 civilians were massacred, was before Mavuzi was born. And now, despite a college education, he can't find a better job than peddling cell phone parts in the capital.
But unfortunately, he failed to bring through economic independence or economic emancipation to the people of Zimbabwe. And we are saying on that he has failed, he should hand over the baton and allow somebody who is able and prepared to bring through that to the people of Zimbabwe, to take over power and actually lead Zimbabwe to a better future.
Yet President Mugabe still has a lot of supporters in the country. They are largely from the older generation, who benefited from the controversial land reform policies that saw mass evictions of the white land-owning class from the colonial era. Mugabe's hardline anti-colonialist policies also brought economic sanctions from the United States in 2001, though they were later reversed by President Obama. Ronnie Danga was one of those who benefited from the controversial land reforms. He was granted farmland in Goromonzi, about 26 miles east of the capital Harare. To him, President Mugabe is the guerrilla leader who fought the British to achieve national liberation.
He has built a lot of schools, a lot of road networks, though they are now neglected because of the economic challenges. But what we are saying is he is a good leader. That one, we cannot take it away from him.
Critics inside the country say Mugabe's policies aren't working, and neither are most people. The country's largest union, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, says the country's unemployment rate has reached 90%. And during the first half of this year, more than 300 firms shut down due to dwindling foreign investment. Cash is literally drying up with a shortage of US dollars that have been the country's currency since 2008, when hyperinflation forced the government to scrape its own money. The government introduced the so-called bond notes, which are supposedly tied to the US dollar, but the bid to reverse the cash crunch quickly ran into trouble with reports of merchants refusing to accept the green paper. More riots are expected as fears of hyperinflation return. It is amid this backdrop that the elderly Robert Mugabe will bid for re-election in 2018. Garikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
FSRN is independent media supported by listeners like you. For more information about how to keep us on the air and online, please visit our website at fsrn.org.
Homelessness in the United States has increased nearly 150% in the last decade, according to the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. The most fortunate among the homeless population have vehicles they can use as shelter. But the LA City Council has voted overwhelmingly, with just one councilman dissenting, to restrict sleeping in cars near homes, schools, and parks, just as voters approved $1.2 billion to build more housing for the homeless. The council majority says the restrictions are an improvement. Critics on the streets believe the move is tone-deaf and will push the homeless further into poverty. FSRN's Lina Nozizwe has our story.
Familiar sightings at Southern California's famed Venice Beach Boardwalk include skaters, bodybuilders, neo-hippies, and street performers.
Them that's got shall get. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it still is news.
Sarah Scott sings in the parking lot of a law office located on the boardwalk. She's here on a sunny but brisk December day to seek help from volunteer lawyers at the Venice Homeless Citation Clinic.
Okay, I need the next person who isn't a check-in.
Okay.
Tickets have accumulated on her vehicle that no longer runs, and that for now doubles as her home. A month and a half ago, the singer-songwriter packed up her belongings and drove her Dodge Ram from Seattle, Washington to Venice, California.
Well, yeah, I'm looking for work and trying to figure out how to navigate in terms of living situations. The rents are really high, and I didn't come with a lot. I just came kind of with a dream.
Scott is one of an estimated 9,500 homeless men, women, and children in Los Angeles, one of the most expensive rental markets in the country, who share sleeping accommodations with a steering wheel. And they will have fewer places to lodge their wheels in the wake of a new ban by the LA City Council that will prohibit sleeping overnight in vehicles near residences, schools, and parks. Instead, those cars, trucks, and RVs will have to seek refuge in industrial or commercial parking lots.
Completely inappropriate, and it's just more of the same.
That's Peggy Lee Kennedy, who has been passionately fighting for the rights of the homeless since 2003. The passage of the ban came just one day after Los Angeles voters approved Proposition HHH, which authorizes more than $1.2 billion in bonds for the construction of 10,000 units of housing for the homeless. The bonds and the ban have been described as a carrot and stick, but Kennedy disagrees.
The stick is more like a mallet, and it's always like that. There's no solutions, and there's only punishment. And then they have this PR machine that comes out and says, well, we just voted to get housing. But the fact is that housing doesn't exist right now, and the law is going to exist. So people don't know where to go. They will be criminalized.
All but one city council member voted for the ban. Councilman Marquise Harris-Dawson voted with the majority.
The other thing I want to point out is that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that aren't here. Every neighborhood council, every church, every community group you go to, people are concerned that people have turned the curb in front of their house or their business into an apartment, essentially. And that's just not fair to anybody.
Legal Aid Foundation attorney Shayla Myers says the L.A. City Council has a history of criminalizing homelessness that dates back to the 80s with Ordinance 8502, which was struck down by the 9th District Court of Appeals 2 years ago.
So the new version of Los Angeles Municipal Code 8502 and its criminalization of people who are living in their vehicles in residential is by no means the first law passed by the city council to criminalize homelessness. So last summer, the city council passed another version of Los Angeles Municipal Code 5611, which places severe restrictions on individuals related to their personal property. That law was challenged in yet another lawsuit in which the Ninth Circuit again found that the city was operating potentially unconstitutionally in how they were using that ordinance. And so the city doubled down and passed another version of that law as well.
This is my first time being homeless. Yeah, I'm trying to pull out of it. All these new rules are making it impossible. They're just, sounds like they're trying to cripple people to the point where they have nothing and then just clean up the mess afterwards.
A financial hardship caused by a traffic accident about a year ago forced Joe, a carpenter by trade, to move into a two-seater sports car. He is fearful about being forced to park and sleep in an industrial area.
Sounds terrifying, because I try to stay in a place where people know who I am.
That's a sentiment shared by singer-songwriter Sarah Scott.
Well, that's very unsafe, isn't it? Especially for females, single females, yeah.
Neither Joe nor Sarah knew much about the ordinance until asked by a reporter, and not knowing could drive them both further into homelessness. Violators of the ban will face fines.
The buildings came down, everything's changed about this town.
Before she became homeless, Sarah Scott wrote a song about the gentrification, or as she put it, the Starbucksification of Seattle. In many iconic California neighborhoods, rents are skyrocketing, with real estate developers catering to high earners from the tech industry. Apartmentlist.com puts the median monthly rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Venice, where Snapchat is based, at $5,200.
Money! You've got lots of friends!
But the woman who sings in the Venice Beach parking lot, wearing a neat black and white gingham dress and brown thong sandals, is optimistic. She's looking for work as a house cleaner if she has to, and she does not want to give up on the music. She has the drive, but just now she says her vehicle, though stalled, is the only thing that literally keeps her off the street. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Venice.
Papa may have, well, God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Simaphone via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.